Thanks for tuning into the Fried Egg Podcast. This is part two of the Kyle Franz Pod. If you missed part one, check it out on our website or in the iTunes or Stitcher feed. In part two, we discuss golf in the British Islands, the ground game and professional golf, desert golf, and we do our segment of overrated, underrated. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to check out our newsletter, the easiest way to keep up with golf. Sign up on our website, thefriedegg.com. And enough of me, here's part two of the Kyle Franz Pod.
I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
So you've spent an extensive amount of time in the British Isles. If you were going to do one trip, you know, we'll say a certain area to see golf and architecture, which like small area would you focus on?
You know, it's pretty hard to argue with the Lothians around Edinburgh. You know, you get such a unique string of golf courses. You can see that. You know, Muirfield is obviously such a great classic course, and really just like sturdy architecture that most everybody will like. You know, it kind of lacks to a degree some of the kind of quirky stuff that a lot of us appreciate in golf in the UK. But it's just such a great sturdy course. You just really can't argue with it. As being one of the best courses in the world. And then to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you've got, you know, North Berwick is just down the road, which, you know, I would say most of my architectural friends, you know, people that I work with, people like Gil and Tom and Bill, you know, all of my friends, I think, to a man would rank North Berwick among their favorite courses because you get just so much weird, fun, crazy British architecture. You know, it's a great coastline. It's a beautiful place. But where else are you going to get to play, you know, a hole like the famous pit where, you know, you're batting your ball out in the fairway and having to stop it on a green right behind a rock wall. You know, you get all the quirk value that you can get in Great Links golf course architecture over there in one setting there. And then there's a lot of, you know, like great secondary courses there. You know, obviously Gullin's a great old classic, a couple of courses there. You know, Loughness, you know, great architecture. Dunbar, just down the road, is a really good course that kind of flies under the radar. You want to talk about, you know, under the radar stuff, that's a pretty cool place. And, you know, I've always, that would be the one market that I would love to personally, you know, jump into as a restoration architect, stuff over there. You know, I spent my year overseas studying golf courses over there, and that was the thing that I always kind of thought about as I go to places, how much fun it would be to consult at a place like that, Dunbar or Fraserburgh or what have you, that you know, with just a little help on one hole here, one hole there, you could turn one of those golf courses into something really, really amazing. They already are really, really good golf courses, but you know, it would come as no surprise, having worked on, you know, the likes of Pacific Dunes and Barnbogle as I started my career, and then having spent all the time overseas in the UK, I'm a huge fan of Lynx architecture, so it would be fun to work on some of those kinds of places over there. You know, and obviously the financials of clubs are so different from the United States that, you know, it would require somebody being really patient and working with a club over a span of probably two decades to actually get it where they want it to go. Well, it's not like, you know, they have the financials to do a massive, you know, restoration or what have you in a summertime like we do here. So that's where, you know, Mid Pines, we did the project essentially in-house with a bunch of shapers and finishing guys that I brought in, no contractors, et cetera. You know, so I've always kind of been, having worked on those projects for Tom and Bill and Ben, you know, Pacific Dunes, there was no contractor whatsoever. I've always kind of tried to build my business model that I could potentially do, you know, projects kind of like that someday.
So,
that's really my favorite region of the country is there. It's all good. I mean, I have a hard time saying that over some of the places we mentioned earlier with Dornick and Barora and Tane and Goolsbee up north. But when you, in terms of world-class architecture, it's pretty hard to beat the Lothians. Pretty good.
With regards to restoring courses in, like, Scotland versus, like, so in America we see, like, a lot of the same problems with, like, overgrowth of trees, shrinkage of greens, you know, narrower fairways. What are some of the issues that you see in Scotland and Ireland and the UK at courses? Are they different or pretty much the same?
It's all the same game. It's about the particulars that you're working on. You know, I think the thing that I saw probably the most is it was always clear to me that there was a lot of golf courses that I went to. There was like maybe one or two greens where it was obvious it was probably like the coolest and craziest green in a golf course. They'd have been kind of flattened out and changed over the decades, where it just been kind of flattened out. It was something very bland and was not really indicative of what it was laid out to be. You know, a lot of those craziest greens over in the UK where it's just something where it was on the ground, that's what worked, and they started mowing it there, you know. And it had been kind of changed over time. You know, a lot of, you know, bunker missing here, bunker missing there. Or, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's just as simple of moving a fairway around a little bit. You know, just mowing another 10 yards to the right, moving in, you know, 10 yards from the left where it is being mown as fairway. Or expanding them back out, narrowing them down in the right place. It's just, you know, simple sort of stuff. But in the end, it ends up making all the difference kind of in the world a lot of the time. So, and also, you know, in terms of bunker style, you know, there's a place in southern England I was just looking at on the internet a couple of months ago. There was an old, back to the previous architect that we talked about, Colt. It was a course that he had done on the coast that was on more uplandy sort of ground. It wasn't sand dunes and a links golf course, but more of like uplandy sort of terrain with big sort of like pebble beachy sort of cliffs. And, you know, the bunkers had all been kind of turned into more like simplified renditions of what they was originally supposed to look like. You know, obviously, for anybody that kind of knows Colt's history, built some really impressive bunkers, really flashy and visually attractive. Stuff, and that stuff had just been kind of wiped out on the golf course over the span of, you know, 100 years. So that's probably the main thing is, you know, restoring bunker style, which is something that just doesn't really happen over there. And, I mean, some has happened the last 10 years or so, but I think if somebody did a really great restoration, like, say, in London, one of those great old, you know, Colt courses, I think it would probably break down the door to doing a lot more all over the city and the region. And the same holds true for the coastline in Britain. You know, I think, you know, if you did a couple projects here, a couple projects there, I think it probably opened the doors to doing a lot of great restoration work like that. And it's really kind of due for it. You know, I think that's one thing that hasn't been. Again, there's been a few projects the last few years that have kind of touched on that in the UK, but it's still restoration is still kind of a new and blossoming conversation over there, whereas it's something that obviously we've been working very hard on in the States for the last, you know, 10 and 15 years, 20 years, mm-hmm. almost 30 in some cases. So
we got a ton of questions from listeners. I wanted to get to a few of them before we get you out of here. Car for the Course had a good one here. Very few, if any, desert courses are lauded as being architectural gems. How would you approach a project in Palm Springs or like Scottsdale area?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing that I have not seen yet, on a golf course out in the desert, which I think would be very, very cool to see, would be something with a little bit more like Pinehurst No. 2 or St. Andrews influence, where the golf course relies less on bunkering and more on really, really fun shots on and around the greens. You know, I think I worked on Stone Eagle for Tom 10 or 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I guess. And then, you know, I've been to a couple of Bill and Ben's projects in the desert, and I think those projects were all great. We built some really cool stuff at Stone Eagle, and I know that Bill and Ben built some great stuff there. But I think that's probably the one little missing link, is that I would love to see more Piners number 2, St. Andrews-y sort of contouring, and even a degree like Prairie Dunes, where you get some really, really good, interesting kind of shot-making and recovery shots around the greens, you know, tight mo and a lot of interesting, fun kind of shots and stuff that almost like kind of forces you to play ground shots. You know, the hard thing with building cool architecture in the desert is, A, it requires quite a bit of water, obviously, and B, the turf types that you're going to have are always going to be not particularly prone to good ground game architecture, which, of course, is, you know, when we're talking about Bill and Ben and Tom and Gil, that's the one thing that I probably should have started with instead of ending with, is they're all committed to building great, classical, cool ground game architecture, and that's something that I'm always trying to push. And but it's hard to do with warm season grasses because it's so bushy and so green and lush, you know. So I think you'd almost want to like over design features, you know, on projects there, and you know, more fall away greens, just lots of cool stuff to really get it to where you know, people want to try some really fun, interesting, you know, ground shots and recovery shots. It's harder to do than to just say it. You know, I think one of the things on the Rio Olympics golf course that certainly was the biggest challenge was trying to get players to play ground shots in warm season grasses because the ball doesn't really like to bounce that much. In some places we were successful with it. In other ways, probably not as much as I would have liked to have seen it. You know, I think it's the key is just how severe your building features and how really dedicated you are to really, really building stuff that really forces people to hit some cool, crazy shots like you do in different settings.
Forcing like guys to hit the ground shots, I feel like the pros just don't hit them because they don't have to hit them regularly, so they don't have to practice them.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, if I ever am lucky enough to design work on courses from scratches on my own, I think that's probably the area that I'd probably be exploring to a degree. Is with the changes in technology, you know, the last 20-25 years, it was almost like some of the cool stuff that we were building was kind of dated the second that it opened for that caliber of player, whereas it still works very well for average players. You know, there's very few kinds of holes in the world these days that'll make professional-level players thinking about, you know, hitting balls on the ground and bouncing around some. You know, obviously, you know, the road hole in St. Andrews is still the timeless example of that. But you even see a degree in a hole like, you know, number 5 at Augusta. You know, if the players hit into the rough on the right-hand side of that hole, they'll start thinking about trying to hit the little skipper shot up onto that little St. Andrews-inspired ridgeline green because the hazards off the back side of the green are so severe. And they'll try and bounce it up. You know, I think Oakmont is great for that, and the fact that you have so many fall away greens, and in some cases the greens are so severely falling away from the players, front to back sloped greens that the players are almost inevitably have to give it a go. Like a hole like 12 at Oakmont, the players have no choice. If you're going for that green, so you have to think about how it's going to bounce onto that green, and even the third shot, so you have to at least be cognizant of the fact that the ball, even with a wedge in your hand, isn't going to spin like it normally would. So I think there's some interesting ways to go about skinning that cat. And, you know, it's all about how you approach the overall theoretics of what you're shaping, what you're designing. And, again, the paradox of scale that we work with to try and make architecture work wherever we are. So, I think that would be a fun golf course to play in the desert. I would like to play that course someday. That would be fun.
Yeah. So Pablo Toledo has a question here. Thoughts on doing a strict restoration versus a renovation that modernizes and attempts to recreate the original design philosophy and intent?
So I repeat that one for me. That was
so. So it's like a true, pure restoration. We're putting everything back into place where we saw it on this aerial photo versus a renovation that, you know, tries to take what the intent was and modernize it for today's game. So, you know, you might move bunkers.
Yep.
So,
yep.
You know, thoughts on each and, you know.
Well, I think that line is always getting blurred, and I really don't know of, I don't think you can be successful in either format without blurring them together. You know, I think that, to do great restoration work, you really have to put yourself in the mind of the original architect. And, you know, certainly a lot of that is painting by numbers, looking at an aerial and seeing what was on the golf course originally and precisely where everything sat. But you also have to take that step back and ask the question, well, why? You know, I think that if you went back and attempted to do restoration by just simply copying, pasting, you know, painting by number, you kind of miss that original intent. You know, the game has evolved and changed so much that bunkers inevitably wind up in the wrong spot, or if you're not seeing the whole big picture very clearly, you'll kind of miss the end all of what the original hole is trying to do. You know, obviously, when we were talking about Mid Pines earlier, we were talking about, you know, Ross's intent with the styling of the holes. And I think the thing that, you know, as I alluded to, he tried to make each of his golf courses here a little bit different. And the best way I can describe the importance of really, really studying the original design is the differences in courses, you know, here in Pinehurst. You know, Pinehurst number 2 was supposed to have big, wide fairways, 50-yard wide fairways, and then on the outsides of the holes, you had an extra buffer of another 20 to 25 yards before you got to the edge of the clearing line into the trees. So it was big, big, wide corridors and big, wide fairways, and then you had these big, long runs of the famous Sandy Hardpan areas on each side of the hole. At Mid Pines, his design philosophy was completely different. The fairways were big and wide like Pinehurst number 2, but he, for the most part, kind of excluded a lot of those sandy hardpan areas on the edges of each hole. Instead of having that buffer, it just went right into the woods and the trees. You'd have a little bit of sandy hardpan and wiregrass, but mostly the holes just kind of went right into the woods. And in between the holes, it was very dense, thick, bushy terrain. It would be wiregrass and wisteria and all kinds of who knows what else was, you know, growing out in the southern jungles of North Carolina. So the idea was that, you know, Pinehurst number 2 was meant to be a little bit more of a resort friendly golf course where it was a bigger, wider area the players could find their ball and play on, where Mid Pines was meant to be kind of this very intimate setting, you know, hard golf course with the tighter clearing lines. And the design evolved further from number 2 in that category. You know, it has more, Mid Pines has more bunkers front right and front left of the green compared to number 2, where most of the holes have quite a bit of bunkering, but there are actually some holes where there's a whole bail side. You know, the first two holes at Pinehurst number 2, you can bail completely away into short, tight mow areas away from all the bunkering around the greens, whereas Mid Pines, there isn't two holes like that in the entire golf course. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that, you know, players could hit tee shots into the right sections of fairways and give themselves good angles past all these front bunkers. You know, if the pin was front left, they could play into the far right-hand side of the fairway for a decent angle. Vice versa, if the pin was front right, they could play to the other side. But to hit it to the good angles, the honey spots on each hole for a good angle in, you had to take on, you know, all that brush and all the nasty stuff that was lapping right at the edge of the fairways, as I was, you know, alluding to before. So there was, you know, to get to the good angles and strategize for a good player on the tee shots, they had to take on some nasty stuff. They were kind of taking their life in their own hands. Again, just differences in philosophy. So when I was working on Mid Pines' restoration, all that jungly stuff around the edges of the holes had been removed over the decades to make it more resort friendly. All the trees were still there, so the general philosophy of the course still kind of held true to the original design. So a lot of what I had to do was, you know, just kind of stand on the tees and visualize, well, all that stuff is gone now, but the trees are still there. But again, it feels a lot, there's a lot less in the way of blood pumping, do or die feel to the tee shots that originally was intended. So what do we need to add to the equation? How do we need to approach adding bunker here, or maybe bringing the sandy hard pan areas into the holes a little bit more there? You know, it's again just trying to add or approach, you know, the restoration of the strategic hazards around the holes in a manner that they would balance out the fact that these other elements had been eliminated over the span of decades, and what it was going to take to get the kind of blood pumping shots back into the equation that that Ross had originally intended. And if I was just looking down at an aerial of the golf course, you'd never figure out any of that stuff. You can't just paint by numbers and be like, well, that's what was there, so that's what we need to do. You know, you need to kind of put yourself in the head of what Ross would have been standing there looking at in 1935 and the decisions that he would have been making to lay out the holes exactly to get the blood pumping kind of shots that he wanted. And so that's how I really, you know, approach restoration is that, you know, you got to get out in the field, you got to stand there and kind of visualize what it would have been like to have a hickory hand 100 years ago. Yeah. And what do we need to do to make that all connect today? You know, so sometimes you wind up in a scenario where, you know, you can just simply paint by numbers, where it's purely restoration. But also, you know, getting it to fit and to work and to be appropriate for modern play requires, you know, making adjustments. And that, too, is restoration. So at the end of the day, it's all the same game. You're just trying to get to where the architecture matches up and plays as well as it did today, as it did originally, or even better.
That's a good answer to that question. I think that's the way you got to do it. It's because so much has changed. So
absolutely, a long explanation, but it really does arrive at the point. You know, you gotta get in the heads of the original architects and figure out the details.
So if you could restore, we'll just say one, you know, municipal or like a public access course that you don't know of having a consulting architect, so, you know, we avoid any, you know, beef, what course would it be? And this is from Andrew Bailey.
I don't know. I probably mentioned a lot of them in my you know, just discussing.
I guess
you know,
had the UK courses. So
yeah, you know, British golf courses.
Yeah.
In terms of the United States, I don't know. You know, one that always just pops to mind is. I'm having a brain meltdown. I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head. There's a place in Portland, Southeast Portland, it's an old H. Chandler Egan golf course that I always was a big fan of growing up, you know. But there's many, many prime examples of great courses in that category. You know, if I had 10 minutes to kind of think about it, I'm sure I could think of some even right here in North Carolina. I wish I could remember the name of that golf course. It'll come to me here in a sec, in Portland. But, you know, a lot of places, you know, just neat old places that are, you know, again, great classic architects that really have a lot of potential. The land is still very good and nobody's really kind of broken anything. Would be fun to work at. And, you know, I mean, especially I think you probably would, understand immediately just from the conversation today that you know, the fact that I grew up on a public golf course has always made me really intrigued with doing great public golf course restoration, you know, or just great public golf in general. I mean, that's what really you know, intrigued me the most about working on the the Olympics course in Rio for Gil was the fact that, of course, it was cool to be involved in a project where I was going to hold the Olympics and the first Olympics in over 100 years. But it was also, I think, equally as important to me that it was going to be the first public golf course in Brazil. And one of the first, like, great examples in South America of a big tournament venue that people could go and play. So, you know, having grown up on a public golf course, public golf is really important to me. So really any place, you know, that you know, has just great old bones, great architecture would be fun to work on for a public benefit. Eastmoreland is the golf course I was thinking of in Portland. I knew that was going to come to me eventually.
So I'm putting you on the spot. So, it's that's a cool part of the Olympic courses. And it looked like, it, you know, they just had the Latin American tour was down there, and it looked like it was in good shape. So that's really good.
Yeah, it really seems to be going fine. You know, I mean, I grew up on golf courses in the Northwest, you know, kind of like that, beyond the one that I even, you know, where I played every day. You know, there was a, you know, one golf course that I really liked playing as a kid was this little Lynx golf course on the Oregon coast called Gearhart. It was a Chandler Egan effort. It was originally laid out by an old Scotsman out in the dunes, but he'd done work on the golf course. And also, you know, it's a club, but Astoria is right up the road from there. It's a neat old dunes golf course. So, you know, there's little cool places all over the place that that it would be great to do, you know, restoration work over a span of time that would be practical for them. It's, you're not going to put them out of business, but really could, you know, take them to an extra level and expand their, you know, potential.
Yeah, to make business. Money. Yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, you know, making I mean, them better, you know, you've got yep. That's what they need to invest in. It's their asset. You can't just let it go to you know, shit over, you know, the course of time. Is you got to invest and make it better.
Exactly. And there's been some great examples of that have gone on around the country. You know, I haven't been to it yet myself, but I'd like to go see it. A place called George E. Wright in Boston, which looks fantastic, you know, and they've been doing just that. You know, they've been working to try and improve it the last decade or so, and it's a great old classic, you know, Ross course. You want to talk about, you know, one that flies under the radar. It looks fantastic. I really need to get over and check it out sometime. And that's a prime example. You know, there's some courses around the country that were, you know, again, laid out by great architects that, you know, with a good practical plan, you know, especially that's where the design build philosophy comes together, to make project practical for them is, you know, by removing the, you know, exorbitant outside contracted costs and doing, you know, projects in a practical manner. It's more stressful on the architects to do it that way, but that's what we're here for. You know, is to get the right product for the right price. And so I really look at the next 20 years in the United States as being a kind of watershed moment for that. You know, restoration has certainly been a great development in the club scene the last 20 and 30 years. And it's great to see that it started to shift through to public golf in places, and hopefully that trend continues. It's something that, you know, again, having been involved or been a public golf person my whole life, would be enormously rewarding to be involved with. So.
Yeah, this I kind of think needs to happen too. It's some, you know, it's a every, you know, so many people I have on the podcast grew up playing public golf. I grew up playing public golf, and it's like, that is so important, is to have, you know, the better the golf courses are to play, like the more people you're going to get to play and get
absolutely
people hooked. It's so we do this overrated, underrated segment. So, you know, I give you something and you got to say if you think it's overrated or underrated. There's no properly rated.
okay.
So so we'll start with 1920s. Donald Ross.
Okay. And am I supposed to name a course or
just in general,
over 800?
In general, was, you know, he has kind of three different distinct time periods of his design, from the 10s to the 20s and 30s. Was 1920s Donald Ross overrated or underrated?
I would say absolutely underrated.
All right. What do you think about the other ones? Is there one that was overrated?
You know, I think that golf course architects are interesting. You know, some of them arrive on the scene and they have all their best ideas and they throw them out there, and that's just simply kind of the career path that they take. You know, is their early work is their best. You know, a lot of good prime examples of that. And then other architects have a tendency to just get better and better and better and better over the span of their careers. And I think Ross was definitely in the latter category. You know, his work was always good, but you know, when I look back at the history of Pinehurst Number 2, there's two things that come to mind: how great it is today and how great it's always been, but also how much it evolved. You know, I have never seen an aerial or a ground photo of the golf course between 1935 and 1907 where it was exactly the same. He was constantly tinkering with it. The style was completely different on all of them. You know, like the original Pinehurst Number 2 was really severe. There was like, you know, I'm sure for a lot of your listeners, they'd be familiar with, you know, Hell's Half Acre at Pine Valley, this big famous hole in the world that you have to cross in your second shot in the seventh hole. Well, that's kind of what Pinehurst Number 2 was like originally. Instead of having these big, you know, clearly defined sweeping fairways that begin at the start of the hole and go all the way, the playable aspects that we were talking about earlier. You know, he had like these big stoppages in the fairways where it would just go into like sandy hardpan and native areas for a stretch, and then it would pick back up. The fairway would start again on the other side. So a lot of kind of Hill's Half Acre-y sorts of stuff out there. It was really hard. You know, it's easy to see why his original design Number 2 was pretty controversial. And you know, I've been hoping a bit on the Pinehurst Number 3 course the last year. You know, they changed a couple of holes to kind of make way for Gill's par 3 course, and that kind of sort of evolved into, you know, doing some other work around the golf course. You know, myself and Kai Golby and Blake Conant, all three of us kind of did a little bit of different periods of stuff on the golf course the last year, and which obviously, you know, has put in my hands a lot of the time. You know, the original area for the aerial for his original design, and it's really very severe. You know, a lot of Pine Valley-ish kind of stuff and places mm-hmm. out there. Now, whether that's good or bad or underrated, overrated, I don't know, but it was a lot different, you know. Yeah. But I think his career did take a nice turn when he decided to start doing more playable stuff that would be more attractive to more normal people. So I think that he had really fallen into a really nice groove with the stuff that he was designing by the 20s and especially the, you know, as you got towards the end of his career. I think that Pinehurst Number 2 is ranked his best course for a reason. You know, it's all the different little elements that he threw in his design style throughout his career, combined with the more playable elements that he kind of evolved to arrive at his best course. But that's not to say that the 1910 stuff or the earlier stuff is better or worse. It's just a little bit different.
You know? He's like a fine wine. He got, you know, as he aged, he got more sophisticated and fuller.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that's not to say that the early ones were pretty darn good too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that that's the thing that I personally hope that that will kind of show its way through in some of the other things going on here. You know, I would love to see Gill kind of throw some of that into you know, his work on course 4, just as a complete curveball and departure to you know, the work that we did on number 2, the work that that I've done on mid pines and pine needles. You know, I've definitely adhered more to the later period of Ross's work, because I've always genuinely felt like that was the best period of his work here. But that doesn't mean that you can do some really interesting things with his more controversial and zany style stuff that he did during the early portion of the century. It'd be pretty cool to see. So who knows? Mm-hmm. See what Gil does.
All right, we'll get to the next one here. Volcano Par 3s from Tom Smith. Overrated, underrated?
I suppose it depends on the format, but I am, I for one am a big fan. You know, I would be hard pressed to say that there's not a better hole on any of the golf courses that I'm currently consulting at than the 11th hole at the Country Club of Charleston, which for anybody who has played in the Azalea, which is kind of a well-known amateur event down in the southeast, which is at Country Club of Charleston every year, the hole's a redan, or reverse redan. You know, it's so all the kind of classic elements of diagonal green with severe back left bunkers or right, depending on if it's a reverse redan or not. But in the case of Country Club of Charleston, it's kind of a 45-degree angle green from front left to back right with these incredibly deep bunkers front right and incredibly deep back left. It reminds me more of like a Charles Banks design hole, where it's one of the classic Rainer McDonald template redans, but it's just absolutely jacked up to the maximum in terms of difficulty. And it's been a famous hole for that reason for a long time. There's been many a player in the Azalea that has actually been trying to hold a lead that just laid up on it and put it up onto the green. So it's that severe of a hole. You know, so I love any kind of green and green sight where you on a par three where you're kind of jacking it up into the air and really leaving the players with some really severe question marks if they miss the green. And especially the strategy involved with the hole, like what I was just describing. You know, the history of the hole is actually kind of interesting. There's evidence that the big mound, Charleston's flat. There's no features naturally there, and the big mounds and features on the property are rumored to go all the way back to the Revolutionary War. The British had when they besieged Charleston, built like all these big things that they would, fortifications, redoubts is what they were called. That it appears that that's probably what the greenside originally was. It's kind of some interesting history to wind up at a very severe golf hole. One hole that I always kind of come back to is having been influential in Ross's career is the second at Dornoch, which I've heard varying degrees of the, you want to talk about like a volcano green. It falls away completely on three sides and with a false front on the front portion of it. And, I've heard varying degrees that Ross was involved in the construction of it, under John Sutherland at Dornoch. And originally he wasn't all that excited about the idea of what the hole was going to be like. Don't quote me on that because I've just heard it in varying degrees, but that when they finished the hole, he thought it was so cool that it was like the light bulb went off for him. And I think that one thing you see in Ross's work everywhere is the willingness to build a green site with a really severe fall off the back. And even going as far as to place a green site on a downslope and just pushing dirt out and out and out, building bunkers and pushing it out until you finally wound up with a really severe fall off the rear side of it. And I think that was probably very influential in his career. That singular green site, because you see that all over the place on Pinehurst number two, whether it's, the famous eighth green where, John Daly had his meltdown where he hit it over the green and swatted his ball because he couldn't quite get it back up onto the green. Mm-hmm. Ross did that all the time, and I think it comes back to, those kind of philosophics, and what you get out of it is, when you have holes with such severe fall-offs on the backside like that, it really does get you kind of thinking back to basics, Maybe I should wind up short of this green and take that mistake out of play, or maybe even just try and bounce it up on the green where I just barely run my way up onto the green, taking the aerial shot that might land on the green and go running off the backside or fly over out of play, So I'm a big fan of green sites that are, kind of jacked up like that. And, having done the Rainer McDonald restoration that I have done, I'm always going to be a sucker for the famous short holes,
And
some of the best ones are always going to be kind of like that, whether it's, like Camargo's like a great example, mm-hmm. I mean, that's about as jacked up and volcano-ish as you're ever going to get right there with a severity around all four sides. So, a big fan.
It's amazing how easy it is to make a bogey on one of those holes just by hitting a good but not great shot. I mean, you just get these putts that are just brutal, and I think that's so cool because it's just straight, like, it's a test of your wedge game. Like, if you hit it in the right spot, it's an easy birdie, but if you just miss barely or play safe, it's going to be really hard to make par.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the funnest features that I've restored is eight at mid pines, mm-hmm. Which is a green exactly like that. I think it's just right out of the two at Dornick influence that Ross got from that hole. The green is just, it's on a down slope, and he just took a bunch of dirt. It's obvious that they went 20, 30 yards up the fairway, just started shoving dirt until they wound up with this tiny little precipice of a volcano green on the down slope. And if you go over, it runs down into this sandy, bunkery native area patch behind the green that's, needless to say, no fun at all to try and get up and down from there. I've had a standing offer for anybody that I've been playing with for 3 years now, I guess, since the restoration, that anybody that gets over that green into that hazard and can get up and down, free beer on Kyle. And it hadn't happened yet. The closest was Pat McGowan, who is part of the family that owns the resorts here and handles a lot of the teaching and whatnot. And he was, 77, I believe, PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. And he was as close as anybody has gotten, whipped out. Mm-hmm. Those kind of holes are really fun, When you finally make a birdie on a hole like that, that's something you talk about. That's the kind of stuff that you remember at the end of the year, no matter what, and the kind of shot that you remind yourself or bring up, chatting with friends for years after that. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that style of hole.
Memorability is important with golf. Alistair Philp has overrated, underrated split fairways.
I think that that's almost a trick question. I think that split fairways are an absolute fantastic design feature, but it's all about the implementation and about doing the design of the hole properly. I would love to, if I'm ever doing design on my own. From scratch, I would love to try stuff like that, especially, kind of breaking holes up a little bit more that way. You don't really see a lot of that. You don't really see a lot of people trying it and actually really, really working out well. Where do you want to play to each side? A lot of the time it just sort of winds up to like, well, I'm going down that side and that's where I'm going forever. Maybe if I have some reason to play to the opposite fairway, I might try it every once in a while, but the key is just getting it all to work. But there's also been some pretty poor examples of that over the last 20 and 30 years, to where they tried to do multiple fairways, and it was just at an expense that, again, for the reasons we were kind of talking about, it just didn't quite work out. There was no reason to play to that side, or it wasn't, the risk actually wasn't worth the reward, or it was just impractical. And it becomes, when you get into that category, it becomes very expensive maintenance. It's maximum expenditure for almost no gain. So I suppose the answer to the question is, if it's a really good architect that knows what they are doing, absolutely. I think it's something that we should be exploring even a little bit more. Whereas if it's in the hands of somebody that doesn't quite know quite how to implement that, it's probably money that's better left unspent.
it forces people to make a decision too, which is always good. It puts a little doubt, am I going the right way? There's a great one at Holston Hills, a Ross course, that eighth hole, I think, or no, seventh hole, the par five, where you know, if you want to play aggressive, you go up the left, but you got to hit a really good tee shot to get it up there. And, you know, the safe play is right, but you're blind and it's longer. But, you know, it's a lot easier to hit.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, again, I think it's something that that I think we should, you know, if it's done right, we should be trying to explore it. I think it's a really, really cool idea. You know, I don't remember what it was for, but it was a couple of years ago, Doak, you know, he did basically like a raffle, you know. He sent out to a bunch of the guys who were either working for him or had worked for him. You know, he was just asking what would be some cool different ideas to try on a project on a flat piece of land, and that's what I came back with was I spent, you know, maybe an hour or so sort of like sketching around and trying to think of, well, what would be some good ways to do some multiple fairway sort of stuff on a flat piece of ground to add some serious variety into the equation. And and the more I kind of sketched around on it, it was like, you know, it's not something that it was the first time I'd done that before. But it reminded me that, you know, that would be a pretty nice way to attack certain kinds of pieces of land where you don't really have a lot of topography. So
You worked on Stonewall North?
Yep.
So I played the mid-am out there. And
oh, nice.
It reminds me, like, the split fairway is almost... You almost got, guys, almost did that on like the 15th there, where you have the centerline bunker kind of acted like
absolutely.
That. And
absolutely.
For those that haven't seen it, that course is this fairway is 90 yards wide, and they have like a fairway bunker right in the middle that's probably 2 yards wide, and you know it's tiny, but we're playing the practice round. I'm playing with two of my buddies, and we all look at it and like, what the hell are we supposed to do here? If you play left of it, there's some woods on the left, so you know, but that's a much better angle. If you play right of it, it's much longer hole, and you have a really bad angle into a wild green. And you know, we all looked at each other and said, let's just, I think we just hit it right at it. And sure enough, I'm playing in the tournament, and I hit like one of my best drives of the day, and it just lands right in the middle of it because I hit it right where I was aiming. And it's just like that. But you know, we didn't. You know, I didn't make a decision, so I got penalized for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, you know, like three at Pacific Dunes is always a hole that I come back to in that category. You know, well, two and three obviously have the center line hazards on the golf course, but three is really more of a, you know, more of a full split fairway sort of arrangement with the bunkers that kind of stretch all through the middle. And what, I mean, that was something that always, you know, like really I marveled at in the design is there were some really cool, fresh ideas that Tom threw to the equation out there. While it was still all practical for the average player, but what a fun hole and what a great par five to really like put it on you right from the tee shot that you've got to have it together. I'm either going down the left hand lane where I'm really gonna have a legit shot at getting to the green in two, or I'm playing right and I'm playing safe the whole way. You know, and you know that was what I thought was really cool and really really fresh about it was the fact that there was a solid effort right from the tee to make you force you into a clear decision whether you're going to simply be playing conservatively the whole way down the hole. Very, very cool way to approach it. And that's where, you know, when I was referring to multiple fairways or whatnot, I was thinking more in terms of having fairways completely disconnected from each other, whether it's a, you know, some sort of creek or ditch or, you know, running, like, wrapping sort of bunker thing.
Like
really full.
Aided Riviera has this
exactly mm-hmm. exactly yeah you know that's I was more kind of referring to something like that, but you know, again, it all goes back to the same point, you know, centerline hazards and forcing people to make decisions, very very quick decisions, and execute is really, it's so much fun, you know. It's just great architecture, and whether it's in a more you know subtle format like a hole like three or two at Pacific Dunes or you know the other holes we were describing, you know, so I think it would be fun to explore more the former, you know, where you're really separating sections of holes and maybe people trying to you know really really figure things out and make some really good concrete decisions. I think there's something that definitely can go even a little bit more aggressive format in that category. But again, it all has to come back to whether it's actually practical and you can actually make the strategy of the holes work and not be kind of a $3 bill.
Yeah, so much of golf architecture, so much of the strategy is driven from the green back, you know, and being able to force strategy off the tee shot and off of a specific tee shot is cool because it's different, and like with everything golf architecture, variety is so important.
Exactly, you know, and as we were discussing, you know, right from the very opening of the podcast, I think that, you know, we always kind of wonder is how much do normal players really understand, like the little clues we try to give them and the strategy that we try to create. You know, a lot of great architecture is just simply about being able to do that and not make it too for confusing for people to figure out. You know, I remember Tom having someone something to the effect that if it takes more than two sentences to explain it, then it's probably too complex. I think when you start talking about multiple fairways and multiple different routes and all those kinds of things, I don't think there's a person under the sun that doesn't figure that out immediately. You know, they're like, well, these are clear options to me. These are clear strategy decisions that I have to make. You know, I think it makes there's a discussion to be made there that it makes a little bit more accessible, architecture a little bit more accessible to people that aren't accustomed to learning the complexities of, well, I've got a bunker front right of the green here. There's a bunker on the left-hand side of the fairway. You know, most people don't get the simple stuff, but it's when you start to get into the more complex stuff that people tend to notice maybe a little bit less. And, multiple fairway stuff is as obvious and interesting as it gets. So certainly something to be said for the accessibility of going that route design-wise.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So, hey, I think we've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for being so generous with it. And, we appreciate it. I feel like we just scratched the surface. We could have talked for 5 more hours, but we don't want to take up your whole afternoon. So, thanks so much for coming on. And we'll look forward to hopefully having you on again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dan. It was a lot of fun. Glad to come on, and I've been a big fan of your podcast for a while. So fun to come on and contribute. Thanks again.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Kyle.